You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome to Here District. It's the Fantastic Voyage. I am the captain of this vessel. Welcome to my first mate, my first number one son, Chris Johnson. Chris, what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm well, MJ. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. Just excited about these playoffs, man. You know, that playoff time for me, definitely, Chris, was always my favorite time of year.
Why was that?
Slam dunks and behind-the-back passes and shot blocks and scudo. These are a few of my favorite things. No, because, you know, that was a time when the superstars were really in the spotlight.
Yeah.
And so I'm in a situation, for example, in Milwaukee, where my Hall of Fame coach, Don Nelson, would ask me to reel my scoring in from probably 30 points a game, 28, 29 points a game, my third year after averaging 26, my second year. I would just throw all that thought process out the window about MJ, I want you to average 20 and about 7 rebounds and play. You know, I'm going out there to bust some behind. I'm going against Dr. J. I'm going against Larry Bird. I'm going against, Dominique Wilkins. I'm going against Albert King, who at the time, the younger brother, Bernard King, was thought to be the up and coming forward. Him and Buck Williams with the New Jersey. You know, I'm going to get Walter Davis, rookie of the year, my rookie year. We swept them in the first round. You know, that's a time when the great players could really shine and make a name for yourself. And so what happens is, it's a series. So it's not like a one and done where you don't see these guys for another month or 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever it is during the regular season. We're seeing them a couple of days later. And back in my day, when they showed our playoff games on tape delay, you might see them the next day. We played a lot of Chris Saturday, Sunday noon games back in the day. Not a lot, but enough. I remember the Sixers specifically, Saturday, Sunday, back to back. And so you had to turn right back around. You know what I'm saying? And go right back at Doc. Go right back at Bird. Go right back at Dominique, who dunked on every single person on our team except me when we played him in the playoffs in 1984, I believe.
Hey, did anybody ever dunk on you?
You know why he didn't dunk on me?
Why is that?
Because I was guarding him, and he would go back door, and I'd be, help, Bob, help, Sydney, help, help, Cecil, help. And he'd go up and rise and throw down a dunk to the point, Chris, where, and I didn't do it, but I should have. But my thought process then, you know me, I needed to get T-shirts printed up that said I got dunked on by Dominique and hand them out to the guys as they got dunked on. Harvey Ketching, here's yours. Bob Lanier, here's yours. You know, Sidney Moncrief, here's yours. Junior, here, take two of them. You know, that kind of thing. But I didn't do it because I didn't want to put them on blast. And it was a tough series. Sure. Tough series. So, but it's playoff basketball.
Yeah.
So and so back in that day, Don Nelson, our Hall of Fame coach, he would have this. No layups ruled in the playoffs. Anybody come in there for a layup, you knock them on their ass. Paul McKeskey, Randy Brewer, Alton Lister, that's your job. Nelly would say, Chris, I'm paying all fines. I'm paying all fines.
Love
so
to
he
hear.
Wanted that kind of physicality. And that has held true throughout the years. It's still the most physical time of the year for basketball. It's still the time when, you know, every possession is magnified. So you can't give up a layup. You'd rather have a guy, I don't care if he's a 90% free throw shooter or not, but knock him down at the free throw line, but also send a message, you know, send a psychological message about the toughness, the physicality you're about to experience when you play against us. And so that was always a great thing. And then the rivalries that would develop between teams. And so we had Tyrese Halliburton come out and say that we don't like each other. You know, we don't like each other. I'm not mad at it. I mean, that's the proper attitude to have. And these two teams, you look at their history, you know, a basketball gate after Giannis scored whatever it was, 60 points.
64.
You know, against them, and then the ball disappears. And you know, so it's all those kinds of storylines that happened in the past definitely have an impact on how these teams feel about each other today. Bobby Portis elbowed, I think it was Isaiah Jackson, and broke his nose, you know, and as you might might witness. Isaiah Jackson is no longer with the Indiana Patriots, but Bobby broke his nose and took him completely out of the game. So, and yeah. then Rick Carlisle went out and got James Johnson, you know, a triple quadruple black belt in Nukon Bu or Jukon Gro or whatever it is that the martial arts that he specializes in, just to bring that toughness. It reminds me, Chris, of Red Auerbach going out and getting a guy by the name of Jungle Jim Lustikoff.
Yeah,
and he was the enforcer.
Yeah,
and so I was thinking Jungle Jim, because you hear that name, you see old video of him. He's always the guy that was right in the middle of fights and throwing the first punch and jumping off the bench and going to get guys. I was thinking, Chris, this guy had to be like 6'8", about 240 back in those days to be the enforcer. This guy was 6'5", 220. It was a different era, but he was a tough guy that a lot of guys feared. So that's the type of atmosphere and attitude that playoff basketball brings. And then the rivalries that spring forth from that, you know, the Bucks in Boston and Larry Bird, the Bucks and the Sixers with Dr. J.
How much of the rivalries in the 80s were due to sort of the media marketing, the propping up or the creating of rivalries by like the fans? Or was it a legitimate hatred and a legitimate dislike for, say, you, Dr. J? Did you dislike Doc, or was this something about the Bucks? Did you dislike Larry? Just talk about the genesis of like how these rivalries in the 80s were created.
Dr. J was one of the classiest guys I've ever been around. He was a guy that I got to know him in Hawaii. The late, great Willie Knowles had a thing called the Soulville Foundation All-Star Game, had a game in Los Angeles at the Forum, and then two games in Hawaii. So we went to Hawaii, and it's into my rookie year. And I had this great, great game against Doc. Gave him 30. He gave me about 45. Hit a game-winning hook shot at half court to win the game in Hilo, Hawaii, in front of about 12,000 people. You can look it up. But he had that kind of magic, like magic. Later had that kind of magic. So Doc and I were cool. We talk all the time. He respected my game. So my rookie year, when we would go to Philadelphia early in the season to play against the Sixers, he would call my hotel room. Hey, Marcus, it's Julius. What are you doing? I was like, man, what's up, Doc? I'm coming to get you in about an hour. You know, go get some lunch. And, you know, I was like, yeah, cool. So he came by. He had this big 600 Mercedes-Benz, big gas-guzzling brown 600, you know, Benz, SEL Benz, the biggest kind you could have. He had his own little dictaphone in the car where he could dictate messages to himself, thoughts that he might have, creative thoughts, business ideas. I was like, why you got that in the car, man? You know, sometimes I'm driving and, you know, maybe up to Jersey or something or New York. And I, you know, I want to remember what I'm thinking. So this is back in the 70s, man. This is 1977. And so he would come pick me up, Chris. He would take me to a restaurant called Bookbinders. And we'd have the clam chowder in Philadelphia and the great seafood fest and all that. And then I would order the cheesecake. He told me how great the cheesecake was. And I was just kind of getting into cheesecake for the first time. So I'd order a piece of cheesecake, eat that. He's like, you like that? And I was like, I love it, man. He's like, oh, yeah, waitress, bring Marcus another piece of cheesecake. I'm like, no, Doc, I'm full. Like, we got to play tonight. We got to play. We got a game in about 4 or 5 hours. He's like, no, you're okay. You're okay. So I eat another piece. He's like, bring him one more. Bring me one more for the road, Mark. So anyway, I finally figured out after a couple of times that Chris, that he was fattening me up like a Thanksgiving turkey, and I stopped going to lunch with him. So from that standpoint, there was no animus. You know, it was nothing but love. He was my idol. Crenshaw High School, 1972, the ABA game of the week. I grew up loving and watching him with the Afro and the Virginia Squires and him and George Gervin doing their thing back in those days. And so it wasn't like I didn't like him, but it was like I was trying to dethrone him as the most elite small forward in the game of basketball.
Right.
So that was the purpose. It wasn't like, you know, I want to go out here and hurt this guy or exact some kind of physical punishment. No, I just want to go out and play my best basketball.
You know, that makes sense.
That competitive fire would come out, you know, and you know the deal. You've had guys in your past, great players that you played with and against. I mean, you and Toby Bailey of UCLA in AAU basketball, there was a bit of a rivalry. You and some other players out there coming up, a definite rivalry. And so it was more from that standpoint. Larry Bird was another situation too, you know, that didn't dislike him. We never said more than two words to each other. How you doing? I'm good. Okay, let's go. You know, but we went at each other and I held my own. Sometimes got the best of him. Sometimes he got the best of me, but it was just that ability to go out there and show what I could do as a player, show that all that preparation during the offseason with my guy Malik Abdul-Mansour, those early mornings on the track and sweltering hours in the gym during the summertime, go out there and just kind of show, you know, where I was as a player. And at that time, I was the first team All-Pro my second year. So that's top five in the world. And so other guys were trying to knock me off my perch. I'm trying to maintain my perch. So it was that constant kind of mindset.
So let me ask you this. So listening to you kind of describe your thought process and what, you know, was motivating you. And don't take this the wrong way, but you were really concerned about your individual standing. So going to the playoffs, did you not have a team concept, or was team success was that part of the motivation as well? Or was it like, okay, I'm the best player, so I'm going to motivate myself, and then everything else is going to take care of itself if I'm motivated?
Well, and this holds true today. Even in today's game, and it's been something that has held true since time immemorial. When you think about basketball and the five-on-five element, if you win your matchup, if you dominate your matchup, or just win your matchup, or just hold even, hold serve, stay even with your matchup, you're playing against a great player. And if everybody does that on that team, you're going to win the game, and you're going to win the series. If everybody at least equalizes the matchup that they're faced with, then you're going to win that particular game and more than likely win the series. So that was the mindset. So yes, it was some individual thought processes behind that, from the pride aspect, from the preparation aspect, but it was more about the success of the team overall and what that success individually could bring to the team. So I knew going against the Sixers, going against the Celtics, I needed to average between 22 and 25 points a game. You know, I knew I had to go out there and put my numbers up because the team relied on me to score points. Me and Sidney Moncrief relied on Harvey Ketchum to block shots. Bob Lanier was our inside presence and mid-range jumper presence going against big guys, high post pass. Everybody had a role. You know how basketball works. But my role was to get up, you know, 17 to 19 shots and put up 20 to 23, 24 points in a playoff game. And if you look at my numbers, my playoff numbers are an increase over my regular season numbers because playoff basketball was always that special to me. I wasn't on the level of playoff Jimmy, but it was that kind of mindset. When the playoffs came, man, I was ready to go. And Butler in a play-in game had, 38 points for the war. You know, all season long, he just kind of acquiesced and deferred to everybody. And he said, when it's time for me to score and shoot, you'll know it. Well, not right now, playoff time, it's time for him to play and score and shoot the basketball. So this whole idea of rivalry and not liking each other. Now, the thing about the Pacers and the Bucks, Chris, it goes deeper than that. I think these two teams, based on all the stuff we had talked about, all the things that they've been involved with each other, the style of play, the Pacers love to push the pace. You know, Tyrese Halliburton is this cocky, you know, Oshkosh, by gosh, you know, emerging superstar. I said last year, you know, that he was a wannabe superstar. He's a superstar in this league. You know, now this year maybe took a little bit of a step back at the start of the season, but finished up strong, got this team off, and they won 7 of 8 games or whatever it was, 6 of 7 games in April. And they're a team that, you know, advanced further last year than people thought they would to the Eastern Conference Finals. And so the mindset of the Bucks has got to be a similar mindset, Chris, that the Sixers had in 1977, in the finals, when they went up 2-0 on the Bill Walton-led Portland Trailblazers. They lost 4 straight games after Maurice Lucas and Daryl Dawkins squared off. You always got to have that little bit of a physicality part of that of the game where you can't back down, where you got to show that you're going to stand up to whatever comes your way. And so they got swept. The Sixers did. And so their slogan, Chris, the next year, all over Philadelphia, big time billboards, was, "We owe you one. We owe you one." Well, they didn't win the next year either. So then the billboards, everybody kind of joked, was, "We owe you two. And then we owe you three." They finally won one, I think, in the early 80s. But it was always, that was always a joke about what you know, what they owed that city because they blew that lead. So, but the Pacers, man, you know, this series is shaping up to be one of the more intense series and with good reason, you know, with good reason.
With the nature of this series getting up and down, how much do you think Brooke Lopez is going to, as far as his matchup with, like, you know, Miles Turner, how much do you think that he's going to be used?
Oh, man, that's a great question. Based on what I have seen so far this season, Doc Rivers has a lot of faith and trust in Brook Lopez. And here's why. Brook has expanded his game. First 7 or 8 years in the league with Brooklyn, I think he shot 7 3-pointers the entire time or whatever. Since that time, he's been one of the most prolific shooting big men from long range in the entire NBA. But outside of that, when you need a bucket, and we saw a little bit of this last year, we've seen it at times this year, you could put Brook down in the post, and he morphs back into New Jersey Turnpike Brook, you know, that Lisa Byington and I call it, where he goes back into that back-to-basket game, and he just overpowers people. See, what a lot of teams do, Chris, you know, they'll put their best kind of big defenders, Siakam or Miles Turner, you know, he'll guard Giannis. And then, you know, you might have the other guy that's left right. over as the rover to try and be the help guy for against Giannis and help Siakam? That other defender. Yeah, either Siakam or Turner, whoever's not on Giannis, will be the rover, kind of roving around trying to protect the paint in case Giannis gets by. So they wind up putting a Nesmith on Brook, you know, or putting a smaller defender, thinking that Brook is just going to stay outside, not be a factor on the offensive glass, and all you got to do is get out there and just try and contest his 3-point shots. Doc has been really good this year. When that happens, teams try to pull that maneuver defensively, sliding Brook right down that post and just letting Brook, and that 7'6 wingspan, he's 7'1", Chris, 290 pounds, just letting him engulf and overpower that smaller defender. So that's always a great arrow to have in your quiver, Brook's ability to still go down in the post. Now, when Coach Bud was here, I remember a stat where Brook's post steps were like really low, like 6 or 7% of his possessions. And Coach Bud got smart. And so the next year or so, those possessions in the post went up to like 13 or 14. And I think he's kind of steadied around 9 or 10, 11 possessions in the post right now. And so he can still get your buckets down low is the point. Now,
no, to your point. So like if what you're saying, yeah, in half court. So in order to take advantage of Brook, we got to get in less of those type of situations. So we got to create, if we're the Pacers, so we got to be up and down. We got to run. We got to get out. And so now we got to like create, you know, mismatches. Brook can't be, you know, kick aheads. Situations in 5-on-4 where, you know, early offense, Brook is still getting up the floor. Yeah. You know, that's going to me, with the Pacers, man, you can play Brook out the game. They're the style of team. They play a style of basketball that can play Brook out the game, out the series, to where we won't see too much of Brook. Now, Kuz, on the other hand, and if you got to go with a Giannis and Kuz look in a situation, or a Portis and a Kuz, you know, then we got action with that type of, with the way the Pacers play. I really believe that this is going to be a Styles makes fight series, and I can't foresee Brook playing that much. Now, sure, in situations, but not as much as he did last season.
Okay. And so let's take a look at some recent numbers. I didn't know this, and I was feeling your point, and I said, well, let me check out the last time the Pacers beat the Bucks, March 11th. The day that Junior Bridgman passed away, I remember it like it was just yesterday, which it almost was. But I just remember that day and that game. My daughter Shiloh had a playoff game, and we were playing the Pacers, and you know all that happened on that same day. So that game had special significance to me because I wanted us to make a statement and really beat this team on their home court, the Pacers. And it was a great game. Should have beat them. That was the game. That was when they had the Hallie Hail, I call it the Hallie Hail Mary. That Hail Mary corner three that Giannis fouled on the four point play. We're up three, lose it by one. Should have won the game. So you look at this game, and the reason I picked this game, Chris, is because to your point, the Pacers obliterated us in transition, bro. 31 to 3 advantage in transition points. So, but you look at Brook Lopez. Now my knee jerk thought process says that Brook Lopez probably wasn't on the floor a whole lot because they were running successfully, but Brook played 36 minutes in that game. Brook was 9-for-11 from the field.
That's hit nice.
Two of his 4 3-point shots, made all three of his free throws, had 7 rebounds, which is really good for Brook. He finished with 23 points and was a plus 16 in that game. Not so bad. When he was on the floor, we outscored the Pacers by 16 points. Even though fast break wise, you know, they went up and down and just ran us ragged.
Yeah.
You know, 31-3. But Brooke was able to contribute enough where it warranted him. And a lot of that had to, let's take a look at defense. I didn't look at block shots. Okay, didn't have a block shot in that game. So it wasn't like he was dominating the interior, but I bet if I looked at the advanced stats, I bet he probably challenged, you know, his fair share of two-point attempts inside. So to your point, I mean, this is the beauty of coaching. As you know, Doc has got to play it by ear. He's got to have his finger on the pulse continually in this series of what's going on. Sometimes it's advantageous to play Brook major minutes. Sometimes it's not. If Bobby continues to do some of the things he's done recently, he may warrant more minutes. You know, if Brook is having a field day shooting threes and it's also dominating the inside and being a problem. Look, this Patriot team, Chris, is one of the worst teams in terms of rebounding the basketball. So what that means to me is that there's going to be some second chance point opportunities if you're aggressive. And what that does is if you're aggressive enough, you can slow them down in terms of what they can get in transition. They're worrying about boxing you out and offensive rebound putbacks. They're battling you tooth and nail on the offensive glass. You can maybe slow them down a few possessions in transition and negate some of that effectiveness. But that's a great point, and that's going to be on Doc. That's why Doc makes the big bucks. Going to be on him. And you know Doc is overly concerned about the Pacers and transition and the Bucks and getting up and down the floor. But again, Chris, this is where, to me, the depth of Milwaukee will continue to come into play in terms of the bodies Doc has available. And so you don't have to play Brook 35 minutes. You can play him 28, 29 minutes. Bobby can eat up some of those minutes. We'll see, you know, what else is available to Doc when the time comes. But it's not like he has to ride Brook like he did when Bobby was out with the 25-game suspension and Jericho Sims was out with the thumb injury. You know, so Doc has some options is my point. But to your point, you got to definitely slow them down in transition because they are, man, they're death running up and down the floor.
And on the Bucks, when you look at the Bucks roster, like, who do you think is best suited to, like, over the course of 48 minutes, if they're tasked with slowing down a guy like a Nebhard, or just trying to figure, you know, like who would guard Nebhard for you? Like,
yeah, well, and so before I answer that question, let me just throw out a stat that someone just texted me was that Obi Toppin ranks eighth in the NBA in points per chance in transition. So he's a problem. You know, that's a big that could be matched up against Brooke. To your point, get out and run and be effective.
Yeah,
and then Benedict Mathurin ranks 18th. You got two guys in the top 20 in terms of efficiency and finishing in transition. So yeah. I'm worried about Nembhard. He's good. Nembhard's specialty is leaking out, understanding when to run. Don Nelson used to always say it's not how fast you run, it's knowing when to run in transition. And Andrew Nembhard is one of the smarter. His IQ, Chris, I don't know if you agree with me, but his IQ, that's why he is such a impactful player, Andrew Nembhard.
Right.
And I'll say the same thing before. This is a smart basketball team with a genius level coach. So you put it all together, you can see why they were a handful, especially the second part of the season. So, but to your specific question, we've got options, Nembhard and Haliburton, both. So now you've got Kevin Porter Jr., who's a great on-ball defender, who's tough as they come in terms of taking up the challenge. Gary Trent, the second, GT2, KPJ. I think either one of those would be able to, I won't say neutralize, but give as much as they're going to get and get into. And Nembhard is good, man, at getting into your head, being physical, you know, doing the little baitcha stuff like he did Bobby Portis. You know, Bobby Portis got suspended a game, but it was because of Andrew Nembhard. That's who faced off with Bobby Portis. And let me say this, that the security guards of the Milwaukee Bucks, you may see them in, as the series continues just as much as you see the players because things will continue to get even more heated. So Danny and Scott and Adam, I mean, they're going to have their work cut out for them. They're going to make their money because you don't want a Bobby to lose his composure or Giannis to lose his composure and take a swing or go after somebody, you know, because they're frustrated or been baited to do so.
Yeah, I don't think anybody on the Bucks will be taking any swings at anybody on the Pacers this series. I think guys are smart. I think guys know what's at stake. I don't think the swing thing, you know, is even going to be in play. I'm gonna be honest with you.
Well,
I think, I think that the level of dislike is overstated by Halliburton. I'm sure they might not like or care for each other, but nobody ain't gonna do no fighting. Too much at stake. They're not trying to lose no game. Fine. You know, too much money is being taken out your pocket to fight nowadays.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean there won't be dust-ups. You know what I mean? There won't be...
Yeah, a dust-up is different than a fight. So a fight is...
But you got to need security to come out. The security's job is dust-ups, dust-up control. Security comes out in any kind of a dust-up. You'll see our three security people,
Shepard Giannis away, Shepard Bobby away.
You saw it happen when Giannis and Malik Beasley kind of got into it, the final games against Detroit. Right. So I agree with you. I mean, hopefully they will show the control not to throw a punch. You know what I mean? So pushing and grabbing and jawing in each other's face, you know, okay, that's the line that you don't want to cross.
Yeah.
And to me, if I'm Rick Carlisle, I may try and get you to cross that line. You know, and Nimhard was so good at that last year with Bobby, it wouldn't shock me. Now, the biggest message that we can continue to send to this team as the playoffs progress is to be composed and to, you know, almost to laugh that stuff off. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I know what, you fool, get out of here. I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to bait me. I'm not going for that this year. I went for it last year. I'm not going for it this year.
And it's also like the personality of the team isn't a team of like fighters types. So they let Sidney Wicks, their game do the talking, right? So for me, it's like, don't like get into, like you're saying, laugh it off. You know Indiana's going to be coming with that light skin chip on the shoulder energy. No, listen. So you got to laugh it off. Bobby, Bobby Giannis, like you got to laugh these dudes off. Like, you know what time this is? Because this is what Halliburton does.
There's a couple of guys that
nobody.
There's a couple of guys on the Bucks that Danny, Scott, and Adam have to keep a close eye on. I'm telling you, Kevin Porter Jr. and Gary Trent II. Not like they're about that life. Not like that. But here's my thing. They're always in the mix. They're always, you know, they're always like the ones that jump right, Gobert.
I know.
Gary Trent II jumped right up in Gobert and pushed him away. If you look at that video, Kevin Porter Jr. went after Jalen Duren. Who goes after Jalen Duren in their right mind? He would. You know, he lost it. That 206 Seattle Rainier Beach mindset. He lost
it.
He ran up
206.
He ran up on it. Rainier Beach. Rainier Beach has produced some really, really tough basketball players between Terrence Williams and Jamal Crawford and these dudes.
Okay.
I know these guys firsthand. Them and Garfield. Now everybody else in Bothell and Zach LaVine. Right. I'm not saying. Well, that's because you're from a different context. You're from a Crenshaw, LA City context.
No. So Roberto Bergeson. Federal way. Now, if you would have said federal way, I would be like, okay. If you say federal way, but you over here talking about the Rainier Beach and this and that. Okay, all right, we'll take it. Go ahead.
See, you got to understand Seattle geography. Federal way, man. That's in the suburbs, man.
That's different.
That's out the five. That's out the sticks. It's a kind of a.
I'm saying the sticks. Them country, Mike Dickerson.
Yeah, them stick dudes.
Them country Washington dudes are a little different, bro.
Yeah, no. You're right. But anyway, I keeping your composure is a big key. Not allowing yourself to be baited. It's an even bigger key, and I think the longer the Bucks are able to maintain composure, don't fall for the okie doke, don't fall for the banana in the tailpipe, they'll be okay.
Last thing on that, I think if Bobby keeps his composure, I think all the Bucks will keep their composure.
Yeah.
There we go.
Well, and Bobby has even more motivation.
Ain't nothing gonna bother me anymore. I done been through so much in my life the last year. I got thrown out of a playoff game. I got robbed. My grandma died. I got suspended for 25 games. Can nobody knock me off my swag no more? Respectfully. Just saying, though. I'm here. I'm ready to hoop. I ain't hooped in a minute. I'm just ready to play ball. Check ball, man. We here.
Bam. How apropos is that? Let's give our producer, Monis and Dylan, you know, let's give them a little bit of a shout out because that was right on.
That's their job. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. But you're in a foul mood today. you're in an interesting mood today. Stoddy Loco, you're having a flashback to Jaha Wilson at USC.
Hey,
and
you're talking about enforcers. It's playoff. This is playoff Chris. Playoff Chris.
Oh, no, and again, that's what makes it so much fun. But I love what Bobby just said. And you forget the mindset and the context of that mindset, everything that he's been through. The grandmother, the suspension, suspended a game last year in the play. And that was gonna be my point too, is that Bobby's mindset, you know, right now where he is in his mindset, he knows he can't let his team down.
He can't
do anything to let his team down.
100%. And then that composure and that silent strength is going to really like be something that these guys can tap into and give them that same confidence. Because if he's chill, gosh, the Bucks and composure is everything in this playoffs to me. You just got to keep real composure.
That's a great point. And final point, I mean, tangibly on the floor, it goes right to your point about Brook Lopez and his foot speed getting back on defense. Is that going to be too much of a challenge for him the way the Pacers are going to play? Pacers who are, you know, top five in transition points and opportunities and pushing it up and down the floor. Bobby Portis, Chris, and I said this the first time I saw him in a Bucks uniform running up and down the floor. He's as fast as any 6'10", 250, 260-pound guy in the league.
And he's in better shape. He's in better shape. To me, he's thinner. He's more svelte now than he was before the suspension.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've noticed, but he looks like his face.
That shot of him we had on the screen just a moment ago.
Yeah, man, he looks thin.
That's first thing. He looked almost gaunt. Bobby looking real slim and trim. So anyway, that's going to be the key. That taking care of the basketball. I think the size of the size of our backcourt is going to be a positive, at least early on in this series, until we see just where Dame is with his situation
Are you saying on Halliburton specifically?
Halliburton, Nembhard is a tough physical, you know, even though just 6'3", 6'4", but he's tough and rugged. The guy that scares me the most is Benedict Mathurin. He's had some moments against us. He's athletic. He's 6'5", about 220, you know, just strong and runs and jumps and can overpower you. But I think between A.J. Green, who battles and fights, but more specifically, Kevin Porter Jr. and Gary Trent II, I think we got guys who can give them all they give us in terms of being physical, especially going to the basket, down in the post, taking it to the hoop, all that good stuff that playoff basketball becomes. And then the three of them not only gives us to it defensively, 93rd percentile in points per possession and effective field goal percentage, but also offensively. They're in the 91st percentile in points per possession, 121.8 points per game per 100 possessions between Trent Jr., KPJ. So my point is they're doing really effective things at both ends of the floor. And Doc has got this comfort zone with them, as we've talked about before, where he's let them play 12 minutes of a quarter against Minnesota, pretty much 12 minutes of a closeout game against the Pistons when we were trying to secure that fifth seed. So he's shown a trust in these guys.
Last thing,
okay,
before we put cappers on stuff, Do you think we'll see any PC, any Pat Connaughton in the playoffs?
Yes, I think we will at some point. You know, if not early, at some point. Doc, he's like, I call him like, Doc's like Linus and Pat's like his security blanket. you know, because he knows what
don't know what that is. Linus,
you know, Charlie Brown cartoons and Lucy and that whole thing. Linus was the guy with the blanket. Every time you see Linus, he's got his blanket. He was the blanket comforted him. The blanket reduced his anxiety.
That's ridiculous.
The blanket kept him from lapsing into major moments of fear and trepidation about what was going to happen. And Doc told me this last year in the playoffs when he played Pat over Ajax, because with Pat, he knows what he's going to get. Ajax is far superior athletically and energy and youth-wise and young legs, but you know what you're going to get with Pat Connaughton. And Pat coming off that 43-point season finale, you got to
the double-double.
You got to suspect that his confidence right now is in a good place. I'm not going to say sky high and he's going to go out there and give you 20,
PC.
You know, hitting that open jumper when you need it. You know, hitting that Connie's corner jumper when the other team is making a run. You put him in, plays great defense. He always makes these plays, Chris, going to his right all the time. Dave Yeager and I were joking about it a few days back because he's always going to that right hand. That's his power hand, that right hand. And so he'll make enough plays, especially in playoff basketball, where possessions really become magnified. And you can't afford to not get the shot you want. You don't have to make every shot, obviously. But you got to get the shot you want on the majority of possession. If you do that, then the percentages as the number one three-point shooting team in the league, one of the top teams in terms of just overall effective field goal percentage, scored in the paint, Giannis in the mid-range, Giannis going to the rim, all that good stuff. You continue to get that effective field goal percentage location-wise that you want. You know, percentages are you're gonna score your requisite amount of points to be not only competitive but to win this series. You got to outscore Indiana. You know, you're not gonna keep them under 100 points probably. Maybe an anomaly type game, but you're not gonna score them overall. You've got to match them bucket for bucket, and I think the Bucks have enough right now to get that done. So we'll see how it pans out. But you know, more playoff game one perspective a little later in the show, but just kind of wanted to continue with the big picture and give you some thoughts about how we feel about the playoff, how we feel about pressure basketball. And let me tell you folks something. This boy right here, Chris Johnson, has hit more game winners. more, you know, the first time he shot a finger roll was a game winner in front of 15,000 people at the sports arena against Modern Day and Miles Simon. And then they were the number one team in the state, and everybody thought they were going to be Crenshaw. Chris hits a finger roll the first time he shot one at the buzzer at the sports arena to win the basketball game. First time he made a three-point shot was against Tribuco Hills that set the game in overtime. You know, first time I saw him hit a game winner, he was, how old were you in Italy? 14, 15 years old, playing against men, 17, 18, 19 years old, hit a top-of-the-key jumper at the buzzer to win the game, and his teammates, Gris, you know, Italian teammates all around. So, you know, my point is that Chris knows a lot about performing in pressure situations and composure under pressure. You know, you may be a hothead in the NBA time frame of 47 minutes, but that last minute, you know, ask Washington State. We're going to pull that video. We're going to post that video. Ask Washington State. You know, under pressure, you're able to pull it together to perform. And that's what playoff basketball is about, Chris.
What does lock in mean?
What does that actually mean? It's just
being like a mental and physical and emotional focus.
Yeah.
Right. Your focus in each one of those areas is at its highest. It's at its height.
Yeah.
And that's to me what lock in is.
On a whole different level than just
much different. And so for the Bucks, you know, the lock in on the communication, on sprinting back, on you know, the little things, rebounding, dominating them on the glass, taking their hearts, you know, holding them underwater, not letting them up, no bubbles, and just completely keeping the foot on the gas.
Yeah.
Keep your foot on their neck. And to me, that's locking in. That's how you beat and defeat these Indiana Pacers.
So that's got to be our theme for this playoff series, this playoff season. No bubbles.
No bubbles. No bubbles.
No bubbles.
No bubbles.
That's what we're putting you away. We're putting you out of your misery.
And we're
moving on. No bubbles.
Air,
no bubbles. I love it. All right, man. We come back. We're going to talk some more basketball. Man, the Here District, fantastic voice. This is the most fantastic time of the year when legacies are established. Playoff basketball. Here District. All right. Welcome back to Here District. A little earlier, we talked about the big picture of game one of the playoffs and the vibe, the good vibe that the Bucks had finishing up the regular season. But one thing to keep in mind as we look at the actual details of game one here in this segment, the Pacers, Chris, they had a pretty solid vibe too. They were 6-1. They were playing some of their best basketball, and they're a team that got to the Eastern Conference Finals last year. So we got to keep that in mind in terms of their mindset. And you got a guy like a Pascal Siakam, Spicy P, who has never lost to the Bucks. And one of my good friends, Lance Reed, pointed that out, and I pointed it back out to him. Well, none of the Pacers pretty much have ever lost to the Bucks, even though Pascal has played two series. These guys beat the Bucks last year in six. But, yeah, man, we got to look at some game one takeaways, right? And for me, Chris, the number one takeaway, and this is what the playoffs are all about. It's about setting the tone early. And that's what the Pacers did, man. They came out with a very physical brand of basketball. You saw it early, right about the 11-minute mark of that first quarter when Nimhard, I always want to call him Nimrod, Andrew Nimhard, who I love. But he ran into Giannis, Chris. He took a running start and just body blocked Giannis from the side. And that, to me, served a couple of purposes. One, that this is going to be a physical series. Nothing's going to come easy for you, big fella. But then number two, and I think this is Rick Carlisle's brilliance in terms of basketball psychology. As a coach, you've got to understand not only the psychology of your team, but the psychology of the opponent. And I think he understood that going after Giannis physically right at the start, hard fouls, Toppin, hard foul, Miles Turner, hard foul, not letting him get any kind of easy path to the basket, put him at the free throw line early, but also that was going to develop in Giannis that spirit of individuality and take away the empowerment mindset, Chris, that he had over the final month of the season when he was off the charts with his distribution. And the number that really backs that up is that his potential assist in this particular game was like, I think, 8. And he averages like 13 potential assists for the season over the last 5 or 6 games, last 8 games or so of the regular season. He was up to almost 19 potential assists a game. And those are, you know, assists where the guy may miss the shot, but it was definitely a shot that was that could have led to an assist. So the potential assist numbers were way down. He got into an individual thing, and he's great. He was great, don't get me wrong. But I think he's got to get back into that empowerment mindset and help guys like Kyle Kuzma and Torian Prince, who didn't have a bucket. I'm not blaming that on Giannis. You can't go donut and blame that on Giannis. But at the same time, as Doc pointed out, Kuzma had 2 shots in the first half. Both of those were in the shot clock, kind of rushed, kind of forced. Got to find a way to get these guys involved.
Definitely the offensive struggles with the Giannis individuality tip. That's a great point. That's a great observation. But I also think a lot of it had to do with just the personnel that was on the floor. Too much of Brooke, too much of maybe Ryan Rollins, Torian Prince. You got to go away from them early if they're not giving you stuff early. In my opinion, you know, the triumvirate, as you like to call them, have developed a high-level chemistry. So it's a dance. It's a delicate dance on when you bring those guys in, who starts, who you start the game off with. But in my opinion, my takeaway, the Pacers hunting Brooke Lopez every time down, whether it be Siakam, Miles Turner on trail 3, Siakam just completely doing whatever he wanted, it created sort of gaps everywhere, you know, openings to where now it's harder to close out on guys that are spotting up for long threes. There's nobody protecting the rim because everybody's stretched out. Like, the Bucks cannot afford to get into that game against Indiana where you'll see Nebhard just dribbling without anyone attached to him several possessions in a row. You'll see him just a lot of space just to look, to survey, to create. For me, that was the takeaway. It was like, you know, guys weren't locked in defensively to the levels they should have been.
Yeah. Okay. And so a couple of things to that point, and I agree. You know, Brooke played 20 minutes. You know, that's it's not a lot of time. A lot of time. But it's not a lot for what he's been playing. So his time was reduced in that game pretty significantly based on what he has been doing the last month or two, 34, 35 minutes. But again, I think Doc saw some of that. Jericho Sims was available. And I thought Jericho Sims, even though he didn't score a bucket, Chris, in his 9 minutes and 35 seconds, that dude needs to be on the floor. I mean, he's got the feet to stay in front of a TJ McConnell off the ball screens and Siakam and those guys, the ability to go out and close out quickly on 3-point shooters. He's, you know, we've talked about him being as athletic as they come. So I think we'll continue to see him get some solid minutes. And Brooke, 20 minutes sounds, I don't know, it sounds about right. I mean, I don't know, maybe you reduce that a little, but I think with Brooke, Chris, you've got the main takeaway from what you just said about Brooke Lopez and Ryan Rollins and guys like that, you got to see how they're going. You know, Brooke is knocking down threes, you know, 4 or 5 threes right off the bat in the first, okay, now you bought yourself a little more time.
Yeah, great.
You make the adjustment and don't put him in such a deep drop defensive mindset. Keep him more level to the ball off of screens, you know, so it's not as long of a run to close out on Miles Turner, who is locating at the top of the key, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, you saw it on several possessions. I mean, for me, it's like when Brookes was in the game in that first half, the Pacers kind of went on these flurries, man, where all you saw was Brook late to closeouts on either Siakam, Miles Turner, or somebody else. And it's, I'm talking about in a row. We have a mailbag question about it this week as well. But MJ, moving forward, we're talking about 20 minutes is not enough. We got to see how Brook starts. But let's dive into that. Like, how many minutes do you give Brook to see if he's got it going before you decide whether or not to ride him out the rest of the game? 5 minutes, 7 minutes, 10 minutes? Like, what is the minute thing? Because I don't know, man. It seems like they went with Brook too long. 20 minutes to me in that type of game when Jericho could have been getting a hand closer on closeouts, showing a little better on the screens, and then that drop coverage, the reaction to the drop coverage, a lot of times Brook was a step slow, a dollar short, and a day late. Jericho's going to be there. So do you start off with Jericho, or do you bring Jericho in with the five-minute mark?
You know, Doc Rivers talked about a lot of that in terms of the offense. And his take on it, Doc's take, was that the ball didn't move. And there was a lot of stagnation. I'm not sure, you know, specifically some of that's probably directed at Giannis, who I thought got into that mano-a-mano battle and won it more often than not. Got to the free throw line, had 36 points, had a fantastic game. The one stat that I posted was that Giannis had one dunk in this game. So Indiana's in that kind of a mindset. One dunk and 36 points. You know, that's the most amount of points he's had one dunk since the 50-point game in the NBA Finals, Game 6, the closeout game. And so that's more of an example of how Indiana played. They played a great game, Chris. They stuck
to their game. Yeah, they did.
You know, Rick Carlisle, they stuck to their game plan. They were sending help late on Giannis. He'd make a move. He'd go to spin. All of a sudden, Nembhard is there, or whomever is in help position to just disrupt him just a little bit. Now, by the time you kick it out to a shooter, shot clock is winding down. You've got some late shot clock situations that that I think the Bucks were in the 73 points per chance, which is not really good in late shot clock situations. And so, you know, when the Bucks got into the paint, they were successful. But the problem is they didn't get into the paint enough. Indiana did a great job of kind of walling off the paint and forcing the Bucks on kickouts from Giannis late to take contested late long jump shots. And, man, they were 7 for 27 on catch and shoot, 13th percentile, 5 for 24, Chris, at above the break, 7th percentile, and then 9 for 36 overall on 3-7 percentile. So will the Bucks? It's easy to say they won't shoot that bad, but they've got to manufacture better shots. They've got to, like Doc said, you got to move the ball. You got to move the ball. So with that being said, Brook, you know, if this team would have shot the ball better and then you still struggled and you still were looking like they looked in this game, I'd have a bigger problem. I guess I'm a Brook fan just to the point of, you know, he's been there. He's experienced. I think he's usable because he can stretch out the defense. I think he can post ups in situations where he's got a smaller player on him and manufacture some points as New Jersey Turnpike Brook. But I don't think it's time to bring him off the bench, as that question on Twitter in our mailbag asked. No, I don't think it's time. I think Brook has earned the right to start without, hands down. It's not going to happen. He's not coming off the bench. But to your point, you got to watch him. If he's not productive, if he's getting burned time and time again, now you got to make a move.
Let me ask you this. Well, what about Ryan Rollins? Can we start off with Kevin Porter Jr.? KPJ has been in the bag. He's been playing well. Or is this a thing where you feel more comfortable? If to me, it seems like you need that type of offensive dynamo out there that can create, that can get downhill, get you a bucket, and then diamond, and he's got size. So my question is, what about Kevin Porter Jr. starting in place of Ryan Rollins?
Well, and you know what will determine that, what will answer that question, is the availability of Dame Lillard. You know, and Dame is close. You know, I don't know if it's going to happen in game two. By the verbiage, by the dust up that we witnessed out there, by how much he was talking, you know, it seems like, you know, he's chomping at the bit to get back out there. So if you're looking at Dame being on the shelf for another two or three games or a couple of games or whatever it's going to be, that's the one position that you can play with a little bit. You know, you can start Kevin Porter Jr. You can bring Ryan. And Doc has even done that down the stretch. I know one game for sure, but that's something I would – if Dame is not going to be available for another two or three games, I would definitely think about inserting Kevin Porter Jr. in there in the beginning. Him and Giannis have developed a tremendous chemistry. You can still stagger the minutes, so you can go with the triumvirate down the stretch in the fourth quarter if you need to. So, I mean, yeah.
I just think – and we'll put a cap on this, but I just think that Kevin Porter Jr. is better equipped right now to be playing the quality minutes at the one than Ryan Rollins. I mean, I don't know if it's experience, a playing experience of how much court time he's actually played, but for me, playoffs comes down to who can make plays in nasty basketball situations. So like after double teams, after swing, you know what I'm talking about, MJ? It's like who can make plays? So you need a guy like KPJ out there who can create something out of a nasty situation, and then he finds his way out of it. Ryan Rollins, I love, but he's not, doesn't have the same bag, doesn't have the same creativity offensively, which is I think the Bucks need the most right now.
Doesn't have the same experience. You know what I mean? He's played wonderfully. But again, and to me, he's just as effective coming off the bench as he is starting Ryan Rollins. Probably even more so in a situation like this where you're matching him up against T.J. McConnell instead of Tyrese Halliburton. You know, so and he did okay. Halliburton
did
3 for 13. Didn't kill us, but Halliburton did kind of in terms of picking us apart and getting downhill and creating that situation where Brook has got to come over and drop. Nice.
12 assists, MJ.
Hook passing it back to Miles Turner or Aaron Nesmith, you know. And so that was a problem. My final point takeaway is, and we'll look at this and about that action, but man, our transition defense has got to be better. Our transition defense. So now we struggle to contain them after we miss shots. They had 22 points per 100 possessions. After we missed, that's the 98th percentile. So they were killing us, and a lot of that is miscommunication, not selling out all the way to bust back and make sure you keep the ball in front of you and stop the ball and protect the basket. It was a lot of basic stuff that we were doing wrong in transition defense.
It's like guys are getting back, but then guys aren't like close to men. And so now guys have to close out and everybody's running in scramble mode. Like we got to be in solid mode. We got to be in stable foundation defensively. Five guys working on a string every time, getting back, seeing the ball. You had too much slippage for me personally defensively for a game of this magnitude. Like you're supposed to come out game one and be locked in on the defensive end. And I don't know if it's a lineup thing. I don't know what was going on, but the Bucks were not locked in defensively like I thought they should have been when they're facing the Pacers team that's kicked their transition wise. Like you would think that would be number one, like stopping transition, getting back every single time down, but then you're reverting back to 2-8 Bucks. It's like, come on, man, this, you know, we got to get that together ASAP.
Yeah, and so as we mentioned this, let's maybe run a few clips, do about that action, and take a look. And so here, right here, so if we freeze it right there, freeze it there. Watch what Taurean Prince does after he throws the lob. He's trying to contest the outlet pass.
But MJ, that's not a contest. You know, you and I know that's not a real life contest.
No, I said he's trying. You know, he makes an attempt. But you don't need that. Forget about that. Get your behind back on defense. You see what happens. He's late getting into the play. All of a sudden, it's a lane. Watch the seal by Miles Turner against Kyle Kuzma. It's just too easy in transition.
This is all Taurean Prince's fault because he comes back into the picture. Now, instead of him closing out here sharp on Nebhard, you know, getting an elbow into him, fouling him, maybe trying to run him out of bounds or something, it was just nothing. The Olay, the Matador defense, Olay, okay, go. You know, I felt like Taurean could have got there with a little hustle.
Well, and even adjusting his position so you don't give up middle. I mean, something different than that kind of home run trot back into the play that leaves a wide open lane for Andrew Nembhard, which gave this team early confidence. These transition buckets, those open threes, they got the crowd got into it. Now you're facing a buzzsaw right now if you're the Bucks. You can't let this team get into buzzsaw mode. They're one of the best offensively in transition in this league, and you cannot allow this kind of stuff to happen. So next play.
Go ahead. You got one more point on that?
Yeah, one more point. Write it down. But watch Brooke right here. This isn't the type of effort that wins championships. Yeah. You see that reach one hand? Like, Brooke could have closed that hole, fouled a guy, sent a message too.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, he's out of position. And again, that urgency. I see no urgency at all from the Bucks in their transition defense on that possession. And then we take a look at this next play. The next play is, again, Nimrod coming down the left side. Come on, this is way too easy to me. I mean, you beat two of your wing defenders, Taurean Prince and Kyle Kuzma. You scoot by Prince, you cross Kuz over left to right to left, and then that's a nice finish. But man, that's too easy. And then you got Brooke right there again. Could probably do a better job of plugging up that hole right there. You know, he didn't want to leave
Miles. Let's be real. Corner. Brooks got a seven. You always say he's got a 7'6" wingspan. Like, get a hand on the basketball, or get some arm, or do something other than the flailing reach that doesn't touch anything. That's twice now we've seen Brooke. And I understand, like, you know, who's ever in the corner, Miles Turner being a 3-point
Miles
threat.
Miles Turner, yeah.
But this is playoffs.
In the corner, but just the whole
get effort. A hand, grab somebody, but he could grab that dude. He can get the ball. Yeah, yeah. He can grab an arm, foul him. Like, this is the era, playoffs of the era. We got to foul dudes too. We got to make dudes earn it at the line.
Right there, you got to grab him. Right there, you just got to go
grab
ahead
and him.
Like Nimhard attacked Giannis in early.
Throw him on the ground. Throw Nimhard on the ground on that play. Grab his and throw him on the ground.
And what that does too, it sends a message that, okay, you hit Giannis hard, I'm gonna hit you hard. Bang,
straight up.
You know,
boom.
A little retribution. So that, but again, just too easy for him to weave and wind his way around the Buck defenders with nobody offering any kind of major resistance right there. And that's not playoff basketball. That's not gonna win you this playoff series against a confident Indiana Pacer basketball team. All right, what we got up next? Let's take a look at the next about that action. So here's, I think, Miles Turner, really good contest against Giannis without fouling. And this is kind of the aggressiveness that they're playing at the defensive end. At the end of that play, watch as right there, just a good job. I mean, just uses his body. I think Giannis didn't really complain, if I recall correctly, that he was fouled on a play. But Turner is good. Turner is long. He's a top five shot blocker, 7 of the past 9 years, able to do a good job at that. And then at the end of this play, Nimhard gets the basketball and does the deceleration for the century. You love deceleration. I see you work out with my daughter and your sister Shiloh all the time on that decel, you like to call it. But I think Andrew Nimhard has one of the prettiest looking decels, man, in the game. That thing is so. Why is that move so effective, man? The decel.
Because your momentum's going one way. Because a defensive player is locked into the offensive player's movement, motion, and speed. And when you slow down, you know you're sliding, and then he slows down to levels of like I don't know what they call that, but super slow motion.
Yeah.
You're jacked up. You're jacked up. You can't do nothing with it. And Nimhard makes a killing off of that. For me personally, though, it's like you knew Nimhard's a Bucks killer. Like, you knew going into this game, he was going to be trying to get off, and you just kind of didn't send a message. So game two, like, you got to send a message to guys, meaning physicality, meaning the same way that they send a message to us, the Bucks, we got to send the same message to them. I didn't see anybody get thrown on the ground. Now, I saw Dame and Halliburton kind of chomping at the bit, getting into it, but nothing it matters unless there's some physicality. There's an elbow, there's a throwdown, there's somebody's hitting the deck, a hard foul across the shoulder. Like, something needs to be done. Game two, man, is to reset this tone. They're like, yo, hey, we're not no punks type stuff.
Right. No, and you're absolutely right with that. The Bucks have the personnel to do that. You mentioned the triumvirate. They were They 15.6 minutes they were on the court together. They were a +4. You know, so they were one of the only combinations, small ball along with Bobby and Giannis with the triumvirate. They were a +4 in about 16 minutes. So to your point, I'd like to see more of them. See if Doc finds a way to integrate them more, because when they came in the second half, in the second quarter, kind of turned the momentum around, got to within 7, then came back out of the game, and all of a sudden that lead was increased. So that's something to think about. But that dust up, let's get back to the dust up. Someone posted on Twitter. I love Twitter, man. I love X, because they always get these people who are really good at lip reading and can tell you exactly what was being said. And you had Siakam saying to Dame, why is he talking?
Why is he talking? And then Halliburton saying, it's time to get these dudes out of here, man. It's time to get these dudes out of here. You know, and Dane was coming right back at him with his, you know, Brookfield section of Oakland trash talk. Dane was, you know, it was interesting. It was just interesting because, you know, Halliburton's expression told me he didn't really want any close-up part of Dame. He was fine chirping from afar, but he didn't want to get, you know, close and up in his face. Yeah. But the fact that Dame was engaged, Dame was fired up, Dame was, you know, Dame was down for it. And I think a lot of that, Chris, you know, is Halliburton. I think you mentioned it in the earlier segment. Halliburton has done a lot of this. He's done a lot of this lately. He's been doing a lot of this Dame time stuff right at Dame. That's just kind of disrespectful for to come at a top 75 guy like that. Isn't that kind of disrespectful?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Halliburton, the Oshkosh in him, he has certain this like personality. No, he has this person. He's a dual. It's the duality of Tyrese Halliburton. But he has like a personality side of him that's like a real like just lame kind of petty type of dude. Like lame. Like this dude. And I like his game, but he does like lame stuff and like the corny this. And now he's chomping it up with Dame. This is what I like about Dame. Dame's out the game. But he understands that, hey, we still got to talk that talk and stand right on some business because I don't know how much Bobby was involved or if Bobby's mentality is super locked in right
off.
Now.
He was off. He was off. He was off.
I don't know. But we need Bobby. We need all the gangsters to be gangsters on the floor, Dame included. To me, Dame and Bobby can be gangsters in the sense of basketball, of imposing their will, of putting fear in a dude based on, you know, you got the game and the talk. So Dame and Bobby got to bring that. They got to bring that side to him because Indiana's feeling good about themselves. They need to be humbled ASAP.
Need to be humbled, need to be knocked off their square. You got to knock them off their square, you know. And to your point, intimidation is a big part of the game. And I'm not talking about, you know, fisticuffs and brawling and all that, but just talking. Don't back down. Get in the guy's face. Take a technical foul for chirping a little bit too much or whatever, or a little too long after the officials asked you to stop.
It's like what your boy Ime Udoka does in Houston. Like he does things like with the opposing, and this is the coach, but he doesn't cross the line, but he'll talk to LeBron. He'll talk stuff to Steph. He'll talk stuff to whoever it is. He'll get into it and let him know that, hey, I'm riding for my guys. But this is that type of series, man, where all hands need to be on deck. So if assistant coaches got to get into it, if head coaches got to get into it, whatever the case is, this is a bad blood series and all you must pull out all stops to get the W, bro.
There's a major difference between a role player and a top 75 player. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? This game kind of showed me even more so Dame's presence, Dame's
gravity,
but even his aura of who he is. You know, Damian Lillard, who he is, what he's meant to this game for as long as he's been in the league, multiple time All-Star, one of the top, you know, point producers this game has seen, and that creates that gravity that you just talked about. But just even bigger, Chris, embracing the challenge. And you mentioned that his trash talking was a part of him embracing. He saw where this challenge is going, and he made sure to insert himself in. Now, people are saying, well, you know, you're sitting on the bench, you need to keep your mouth closed. No. You know, you're part of this team. You're part of this team. You got your guys back. And if these guys are not having the personality trait where they're going to talk back and raise to the occasion and feel a little humbled because you're getting your butts kicked, you got to remind them, if you're Dame, no, this is just one game. Like last year's playoffs against them. We won the first game. Dame had like 35 points in the first quarter, whatever. We won game one, but then the Pacers were able to regroup and bring the fight to us. We've got to do that in this series. They kicked our butt in game one.
Last thing on that, along the lines of what you're talking about, Giannis got to really like be that like guy too. He's got to bring that fight. He's got to bring that dog. He's got to bring that talking, that stuff talk, that trash talk. He's got to push the lines. He's got to push the line. So he's got to do it a lot. He's got to get into it because it's going to set a stump. It's going to set a tone, and it's going to turn his level of play up. Like we need that Giannis, that just that monster, that unstoppable, living in the top of the square dude that we know he can be. And we need a dude that's going to be talking stuff to Pascal, talking stuff to Miles Turner, getting in light-skinned Halliburton face.
You know, one dunk, 36 points. I want to see Giannis with four or five dunks. I want to see him dunk on Turner. I want to see him dunk on Obi Toppin or that help defender Pascal Siakam coming over late.
Yes, sir.
You know they're going to hit you, but you're going to elevate so quick and so strong. You're going to power through that contact and dunk in their face and then stand over them, do a little flex, do a Giannis mean mug. You know, we need to see that. We need to see that. It's starting in game two. So anyway, that's what makes it all fun, man. The playoffs are here. The first Sal Bowl has been fired by the Indiana Pacers. Now we'll see how the Bucks respond in game two, man. But this is what it's all about. This is what makes it so much fun. You're playing a team over and over and over again in a series like this, and it's game-to-game adjustments. But more importantly, it's about that mental mindset, man. You got to have that toughness, that mental toughness. How bad do you want this? To what lengths are you willing to go to win this series? And so we'll find out really soon. So, all right, here, District. We'll come right back at you after the series progresses and give you some more of our takeaways and insights. So here, District, man. I'll see you later.
Peace.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.